I'm Nathan Sterner, and this is Midday. In 2010, Baltimore officials unveiled the city's Vacants-to-Value program, aimed at rehabbing abandoned properties and eliminating blight. But while Baltimore boasts that more than 1,585 houses have been renovated and occupied through the program, a recent investigation found that the real number is closer to just 906 homes. In this hour, we look at the good, bad, and ugly aspects of Baltimore's efforts to address its vacant property crisis. Joining us is Joan Jacobson, author of a recent report on Vacants to Value, and a housing expert from the Community Law Center. We'll also hear from a community organizer about the challenges of living on a block that's pockmarked by abandoned properties. All coming up on today's edition of Midday, but first, the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday here on WYPR. I'm Nathan Sterner, in today for Sheila Cast. In December 2014, Baltimore officials put the number of vacant properties in the city at 16,636. Other sources estimated that the real figure may be as much as three times that, as high as 46,000 properties. Whatever the accurate number is, a drive through most inner-city communities in Baltimore reinforces a painful truth, that there are a substantial number of vacant, abandoned, and derelict properties in the city. Last week, the nonprofit Able Foundation released an investigative report by veteran journalist Joan Jacobson on a city program designed to eliminate some of the city's vacant properties. The program, called Vacants to Value, began in 2010 by Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake. It mixes enforcement of code violations with incentives for buyers to spark renovation in areas where the housing market is deemed to have potential. The city of Baltimore has claimed that Vacants to Value renovated 1,585 houses in its first 4 years. The real figure, according to this report from the Able Foundation, is somewhere closer to 900 houses. Later this hour, we'll hear about Baltimore's problems with vacants from a lawyer from the Community Law Center and from Grace Willis, who serves on the Greater Greenmount Community Association. But up first, we welcome Joan Jacobson to the show, a freelance journalist and researcher. For the past 10 months, she's been probing the effectiveness and accuracy of the city's Vacants to Value program and written an investigative report for the Able Foundation. A link to that report is available on the Midday page. The investigation finds that city housing officials, quote, created a false sense of the program's role in triggering the transformation of vacant properties. That was evident, she concluded, when the number of building permits let for renovation and redevelopment did not match up with the addresses listed by the city on its vacant-to-value list. The figures were off by more than 200 properties, she found. In addition, she found that nearly 300 houses listed as part of the successes of the program were purchased by investors on the private market and had no involvement in Vacants to Value. Joan Jacobson, welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me.
So what was the problem with compiling an accurate report on the number of Vacants to Value properties that actually went from vacant to value?
Well, the main problem was getting the list of properties the city said were renovated under this program. They're not posted anywhere on the city's Vacants to Value website. They're not easily obtainable. I did request them. After a few months, they gave me the list, and I proceeded to check every address on the list to match it with building permits, to research ownership records to see if the city had sold them or if someone else had. The city-owned properties are part of Vacants to Value. So I evaluated them that way and did find, as you just said, that several hundred are not part of Vacants to Value. Either they had no building permits for renovation, several hundred had building permits for renovation that predated Vacants to Value, and others, as you mentioned, were purchased by investors on the private market with no connection to Vacants to Value. That said, I also evaluated the program in a broader context and found that it's a good, solid foundation for a beginning of a program to renovate the city's houses. They have streamlined their process to sell their own buildings. It used to be really difficult to buy a city house to renovate. The city now can do that within a few months, and they carefully vet purchasers, make sure they're not slumlords, make sure they have access to funds to renovate houses. They also have a very successful program called receivership. It's a complicated legal system whereby they actually sue the owner of a vacant house try to get the owner to come to court to agree to renovate it. And if they don't, which most of them don't, a judge assigns the building to a nonprofit called One House at a Time that holds an auction and sells it to someone who will renovate it. Now, the city has sued about 2,000 owners of 2,000 houses, and only a few hundred have been actually renovated. Actually, 300 were renovated by original owners, and then about 130 were renovated in the first 4 years after they were sold. So it's a long process, but it does work.
So all in all, your conclusion is vacancy to value is working, just not as well as the city
Correct. May
be saying it's
right.
working.
Right, and it's also limited in scope. It only targets certain neighborhoods.
Let's get to that in a moment. But first up, what is the definition of a vacant? I understand it's different depending on different people you ask.
It depends on who you ask. Now, the city government says a vacant building is one only that is cited by a housing inspector as being vacant. And until recently, that would be a building that they found that, say, had a hole in the roof, had broken windows.
So not just vacant, but derelict.
Derelict, yes. And they've recently changed the law to adjust it so that they can cite others that are vacant that don't, say, have open access or broken windows. That said, they usually use a number of 16,000. The real number, as you said in your introduction, is closer to 17,000. Now, the U.S. Census counts any unoccupied resident, and that could include 10 apartments in one building that hasn't had mail delivered for 90 days. So the U.S. Census lists something like 45,000, 46,000. Now, the real number is somewhere in between. It's around 31,000, and that was data that was analyzed by the Baltimore Neighborhood Indicators Alliance. They're out of the Jacob France Institute at University of Baltimore. So the number is more than the 16,000 the city cites.
It all depends on the way you're looking at it.
Exactly.
I mentioned before we started the show that there has been a house directly across from my house that no one has lived in for the last five years.
Right.
But it's being maintained.
Right.
It's been on and off the market.
Right.
It's certainly not a vacant under the Vacants to Value program, but might be under the census.
Right, might be. And also, there's an organization called Housing Our Neighborhoods. They're an affordable housing group, and they sent volunteers into some neighborhoods in East Baltimore and talked to neighbors, walked around the buildings to see which were vacant, and they found more than 100 in a course of several blocks that were not counted by the city.
And the city uses inspectors to determine what's vacant?
Yes, housing inspectors, yes. It's actually a vacant building notice sent to the owner ordering them to renovate it.
If the inspector doesn't get out, it doesn't get classified as
it
vacant,
doesn't.
Even if it
That's correct.
Patently is.
Correct.
You've said that there are some communities that have benefited significantly from vacants to value. Which communities?
Okay, well, I'll give you a couple examples. Oliver in East Baltimore and Greenmount West, which is just north of downtown. Both of those neighborhoods are really changing on several blocks rapidly. In Oliver, there's a nonprofit developer called TRF, or the Reinvestment Fund, and they're from Philadelphia, and they came to Baltimore and at the request of Build, I believe, and they have renovated many houses in Oliver. Now, let me pause to say they were able to do this because they had a $100 million development fund. One of the biggest drawbacks of vacancy to value is the lack of financing. There's no city money, there's no state money, and there's very little private capital from loan companies and banks. And the city needs to get out and figure out a way to solve that problem. TRF came with a fund. So they have renovated more than 100 houses just in Oliver alone. And you can go on blocks in Oliver and not even recognize the old Oliver.
But for these developments to work, the developers have to come in with a significant amount of cash on
their
own.
Yes.
When Mayor Rawlings Blake unveiled this program, there was already a similar one in place, a Project Scope. Before that, there was the well-known Dollar House program.
Right.
How is vacants to value different and similar to these?
Sure. Well, Dollar House program was from 40 years ago, and it was funded with government funds completely. It had federal funds. It had city bond funds. And it was only for owner-occupants. Vacants to value is for anybody, and most of the vacants to value properties are rental. A dollar house program were for owner-occupants. You got a loan, a very low-interest loan from the city, and the city government employees handled your loan. Your contractors only got paid when the city came out and made sure the work was done. The city would release the money. And that's how that worked. Project Scope was a project that only dealt with city-owned properties being sold using local real estate agents and brokers. And that appeared to be working well until the recession. And at the end of Project Scope, there were only two houses sold the last year, which was 2010, which was the year vacance to value began.
Since 2010, has the number of vacants in the city gone up or gone down?
It's gone up, generally. In neighborhoods I mentioned, Greenmount, West, and Oliver, they've gone down. But citywide, they've gone up by more than 500 in the first 4 years. And that's problematic. The city needs to really take a close look at its vacants and how they become vacant. The city does nothing to prevent houses from going vacant, and there are things they can do.
And part of the problem, as we've alluded to so far, is that vacance to value does not focus on the entirety of the city. It uses
Correct.
The housing market to figure out where it is a market for redevelopment,
yes.
as it says. In your report, you've noted that the city has some 12,000 vacant properties that aren't part of vacance to value because they are in stressed markets, places
right.
the city says just doesn't have the potential for sale or new housing. So what happens in these neighborhoods where there are a lot of vacants, but the city says there's no market? High density.
Well, high vacants. Density, and I think your next guest can definitely address that. But the city does have some money to demolish, and they are demolishing blocks of vacants in some of these really distressed areas, like parts of Park Heights and Northwest, for example. And that 12,000 number is just the number the city counts against. So there are probably more in those neighborhoods that are not counted, that are not being addressed by vacants to value.
Is the city doing anything on prevention, on preventing houses from becoming vacant in the first place, assistance for owners who need help to stay in their houses or to rehab properties?
I would argue they're doing very little. One of the things that they could do is take a close look at the tax sale program. I believe the tax sale process does create vacants. This is a program, or it's a law, that requires the city to sell the liens on buildings, including houses occupied by, say, elderly homeowners, to sell the liens of unpaid taxes and water bills to any investor or anyone. And after a period of time, if the owner cannot redeem their own home by paying the lien plus 18% interest, the purchaser of the tax lien can foreclose and take control of the property. Now, a lot of these purchasers foreclose, but they don't record the deeds because they turns out they have to pay even more taxes. They have to pay up-to-date taxes. And so the city holds the deed hostage until they do. And the city government has drawers full of unrecorded deeds. And so there's no owner of record, and those houses often are vacant.
So these houses are sitting there. The
yes.
city has the deeds, but no one
right.
actually owns the deeds?
Well, no one has recorded the new owner. I'll give you an example. There's a house on Main Avenue in Howard Park in very far northwest Baltimore City. Large house was divided into four apartments. They were all occupied. Owner did not pay the taxes. It was sold a tax sale, eventually foreclosed on. The judge signed an eviction notice for all the families in the house. They were all evicted. I went back a year later, and the house was still empty. At that point, the deed was not recorded, and I called the original owner who lost at a tax sale, and he said that he was still getting violation notices for uncut grass for a lawn he didn't own anymore. So how does that help anybody? You know, the city needs to look at that system and find ways to correct it to prevent houses from going vacant. That's an example.
But is anyone really looking at fixing that part of the system?
Not yet.
So one more thing that needs to be done as
right.
we try to address this
right.
problem. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll continue our discussion with freelance journalist and researcher Joan Jacobson. She's just authored a report for the local nonprofit Able Foundation about the city's Vacance to Value program. Also joining us in the rest of the program will be Robin Jacobs, an attorney and housing expert at the Community Law Center. And we would like to hear from you, too. Do you live near vacant buildings or houses in Baltimore? How's it affected your life? Give us a call, 410-662-8780, or email us, midday@wypr.org. We hope to take your calls and emails when we get back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday here on WYPR. I'm Nathan Sterner, in today for Sheila Cast. This hour, we're talking about Baltimore's problem with vacant properties, why the city has so many of them, and what it's like to live on a block or in a neighborhood that's dominated by boarded-up vacant row homes and dealing with the health and safety threats that come along with that. With us this hour, Joan Jacobson, freelance journalist and researcher. She's written an investigative report for the Able Foundation, a local nonprofit, on the city's Vacants to Value program. Her findings that while the city's overstated its successes and created a false sense of the program's role in triggering the transformation of vacant properties, it has also been a successful method of aiding some city neighborhoods struggling to recover from the recession. Robin Jacobs is now joining us as well. Robin is the Director of Strategic Legal Services Projects for the Community Law Center. She's worked with community groups to address the issue of vacant properties, including bringing a suit against the owner of 57 vacant properties in neighborhoods covered by six community organizations. Robin Jacobs, welcome to Midday.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also joining us, Grace Willis of the Greater Greenmount Community Association. Greater Greenmount was part of the suit that Robin Jacobs took on. Grace, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And we also invite listeners to join us. Do you live near vacant buildings or houses in Baltimore? What's it like? You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Grace Willis, I want to go to you first. I understand you recently took a walk through your neighborhood and tried to tally up all of the vacant properties you saw.
This happened several years ago, and that was one of the reasons we got involved with the Community Law Center, because we found that within the boundaries of our community association, there were over 200 vacancies. Now, a lot of them on the west side of Greenmount have been taken care of because Telus's is redeveloping in that area. But on the Midway, on the east side of Greenmount Avenue, I don't see much progress being made there.
What's it like to live in a place where progress is not being made?
It's very depressing because I've lived near a vacant house, which is now torn down, but you're worried constantly about vagrants, you're worried about fires, you're worried about damage to your property, and it's just depressing to wake up to every day. We've eliminated that problem now, though, because we have that land cleared and we put a garden there.
That's a far nicer thing to have in your neighborhood.
Right.
Robin, the Community Law Center organized with six community groups, as I mentioned, to sue the owner of 57 vacant properties in a case that goes all the way back to 2013. Can you tell us more about this case?
Sure. So we have heard from communities like Grace's over many years that the vacant property is just a really big concern for neighborhood associations, and it seems like a very uphill battle for them. And Community Law Center actually helped pass a law some time ago, the Community Bill of Rights, which allows community associations to bring a suit against an owner of vacant property or nuisance property. And so using that law, we were able to bring together six community groups all across the city. I think that's one of the real strengths of the lawsuit, where neighborhoods and East and West and Southwest Baltimore came together to sue one. It's one individual. The properties, it gets a bit more complicated than that, of course, but there's nine limited liability companies or LLCs.
All owned by the same person.
And then there's, to add to that, there were two management companies in Texas as well that were eventually joined to the suit. So we filed the suit with representing the community associations. And we were able to reach a settlement this last summer that requires certain remediation to the properties. It's just been a really great experience working with all these different community associations and giving them the ability to do something about vacant properties in their community.
That settlement came over the summer?
Yes.
How much has been done since then?
It's still a work in progress, for sure. But, you know, we are working with the defendants to make sure that the work is completed. And, you know, in some cases, these properties had to be demolished. And in a handful, they will be the exterior will be rehabbed. And then there was also a monetary settlement as part of the lawsuit. So that I think that was a really monumental moment for the communities that have suffered from disinvestment for so long to finally see that tide reverse and have to force the defendants' funds back into the neighborhood as opposed to always just taking away.
Robin, you mentioned the nuisance properties, worse than just vacant properties. Joan Jacobson, what is the difference and how is the city addressing that? Or you can weigh in as well.
Well, Robin could weigh in. Why don't I let Robin answer that? Okay. She's the lawyer. So.
A vacant building that's cited with a vacant building notice is actually a per se nuisance under the Baltimore City law. So there's actually some very strong laws in Baltimore City that are on the books. And that actually enabled us to achieve a partial summary judgment in the case. It was later challenged. But a nuisance is basically an when you're a lawyer, you think about property as a bundle of sticks, right? You have all these rights as a property owner. But one of the things you don't have the right to do is to impinge on other people's rights. So like Grace was talking about how the property next to her was affecting her property. You can't have an irresponsible use of property that unreasonably negatively affects the public or the neighbor. So that's considered a nuisance under the law. So it's not a right you have as a property owner. You have lots of property rights as a property owner, but you don't have the right to use your property unreasonably.
In a way that impinges on the rights of your
neighbors. Others, right, exactly.
Going to the phones now at 410-662-8780. That's 410-662-8780. David from Baltimore, welcome to Midday.
Hey. It's hard to know where to start on this vacant issue. You know, when I think about, I'm a property manager and I'm also a rehabber. And when I think about Baltimore City, I really think the biggest issue our town has is density and its density of housing. We went from 1.1 million, now we're in the fives or whatever it is. And we have these zombies that need to be cut out so we can have an opportunity to repurpose this land. Now, what I find is very frustrating on the city level is the city is not a very good business partner to do rehabs with. You could have two different inspectors tell you to do two different things, and they're both right. And it's just really difficult to try and work within that minutia of the city. So I actually do my work in the county. County gets my money, and I leave the city alone to continue to struggle. But I really love to have the people talking about what are some really simple ideas where we can really ramp up is tearing down these properties. I know D.C. has a higher tax on vacants. I would also make a bet that if we just reached out to a lot of these owners who own these zombie properties, they would give them back, maybe pay $1,000 or $2 to get them out of their hair, where we could pull this capital and start tearing them down. But I'd really like to hear, what can a city do to get rid of not just the 100 or 200 properties, but the 20, 30,000 properties that contribute to all kinds of problems that Baltimore has.
Thanks for your call, David. You mentioned zombie properties. That's properties where it's not really clear who owns them. Is that right,
That is
Jen?
Correct, and it's usually used to refer to properties that have been foreclosed on by a mortgage company or a bank, and whoever occupied the property has been evicted, and the mortgage company or bank declines or refuses to take title, to record a new deed, or to sell it to someone who will. And so the ownership remains in limbo. And Baltimore does have several hundred zombie properties. And that's similar to what I talked about earlier about the tax sale properties that also go vacant. So that's what he's referring to about zombies. And Robin, do you want to talk about the higher taxes that Washington, D.C. Charges on vacant properties?
Sure. So one thing to keep in mind with tax, though, is you're adding those liens to the properties. And then in some instances, a fine or a tax is going to motivate the owner to take action. But that's not always the case. And sometimes a lot of properties that are vacant in Baltimore City have a lot of liens on them. So we work a lot at Community Law Center with community gardens, and I've seen, you know, vacant lots where someone wants to acquire the property to do some community garden work, but there's $1 million of liens on it. So you have to be careful with those changes, because sometimes it can just push the property. In Baltimore City, it's a different market than Washington, D.C., and sometimes you could just end up with more liens on the property. So I think the city has to be very careful about how it goes about dealing with vacant properties. I don't think that there's really one simple solution. I think it is going to require a lot of different solutions kind of all coming together at once. And I guess on the zombie side of properties, I'm most familiar in the tax sale foreclosure context. The defendant in the lawsuit we've been working on actually acquired all the properties through tax sale, almost all of them. And that's how I became really interested in that process. And that's something I really think the city can work on, and all of us can work on fixing, because, you know, if we're not collecting taxes on these properties, that affects everything. It affects our schools and our police and our fire. I mean, a third of the city's revenue comes from property tax. So it's really essential that we have that system working, and that it doesn't encourage more irresponsible property ownership as it does now.
And so these properties that aren't really registered, there's no tax.
Well, so technically, it's an account. I think it's kind of like the city counts it as receivable. So there's an auction every May of the tax lien certificates, like Joan was talking about earlier. And investors, or I would mostly speculators, there's about six of them that get most of the tax sale certificates every year, pick up the certificates, and then many of them foreclose on the properties. Oftentimes, they're after the redemption rate, because there's an 18% interest rate on these. Right now, I understand that the city's going to change that to 12%. So I think that will help. But, you know, homeowners get stuck in the system, and it's a very complicated system. It's definitely a system where the sort of sophisticated investors are able to make a lot of money, and they're pretty much the only winners in the system. I think the communities really lose out, vulnerable homeowners lose out, and the city as a whole really loses out from some revenue that they could collect themselves.
Can I add one more thing that, in answer to your caller's question of what can you do about the zombie properties? This is one suggestion. Actually, it's Robin's idea of passing a law requiring owners to record deeds. So if a bank foreclosed on a property, they would have to record the deed in their name. Also, there are other things that can be done. For example, in Cleveland, they have a vacant house council that worked with banks that had foreclosed on properties that were vacant and convinced banks to help pay for the demolition of the houses they'd foreclosed on. So that's another solution.
You're listening to Midday here on Your Public Radio, WYPR, talking about vacant houses in Baltimore. Of course, vacant property is not just a problem here in Baltimore City, but in other cities around the country, Cleveland one, another Detroit. Going to the phones to Lorenzo in Baltimore, who has some perspectives from Detroit. Lorenzo, welcome to Midday.
Thank you very much. So in full disclosure, I'm a real estate broker, so I'm in the business of selling properties here in Baltimore City, and I've sold quite a few vacant properties, and I've dealt with quite a few buyers and sellers of these properties. But I also have a perspective because I lived in Detroit for about 13 years and was in a real estate. I left in Detroit back in 2002. And there were, even when times were good, there were vacant properties all over Detroit, just like here in Baltimore. And what I see that Baltimore has a little bit more benefit over Detroit is, it's got a suburban community that's interested in the city, more dialed in so much than Detroit. Also, Baltimore City has, there's a lot of jobs here. The government's not very far away, so it creates jobs. But, at the time when I was in Detroit, the car industry was really big, and it was still really bad in Baltimore City, in Detroit. So, in my opinion, if this thing doesn't get under control very quickly, you know, Baltimore could become, you know, Detroit real fast. Say the wrong politicians get in office and stop federal hiring or cut federal jobs or whatever. There goes a lot of the job base, and herein comes a huge problem. And all of a sudden, you're starting to tear down whole city blocks like there are in Detroit. One other point I want to make also in dealing with listings here in Baltimore City, it is nothing. I mean, it happens all the time that you walk into a vacant property or the property of an investor who lives somewhere else, and there's a vagrant living in there. There's someone squatting in there. It happens all the time. There are so many squatters living in a lot of these properties. I'd like maybe someone to answer what the city can do about that.
Thank you for your call, Lorenzo.
So I guess what the city can do about that, I wrote an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun where I tried to outline some ideas that I basically have just heard the last few years working with community groups like Graces. You know, I think a more well-resourced revitalization efforts, making it easier to navigate the city agencies. It's interesting to get the call from people even in the development community that have that issue, but that's something I hear from residents all the time, that they have a hard time figuring out where to go with issues, reforming the policies. And then I think the city can lead by example. The city actually owns a lot of vacant properties, and in a lot of communities, I hear that those are some of the worst properties they're having to deal with. And that's something where
why is that? Does the city not crack down on itself at all? Or
well, the city does have governmental immunity, so yeah.
So yeah,
I always tell people when they ask me about those that they should really get out and vote. That's the solution there. But there's an effort. I'd love Grace to kind of chime in here to talk about the Baltimore Residents Engaged in Neighborhood Empowerment and Well-Being, or Baltimore Renew. We just had a really exciting meeting a couple weeks ago where we put out a call to all the community association leaders to organize around vacant properties. And I really do believe that it's the residents like Grace that know the solution and know the way forward, and we really have to listen to them.
Grace.
We had a very large turnout at St. Mark's Church, and we had people from all over the city to come and represent their community associations. And they have expressed an interest in this coalition, and we are hoping that it's going to really be successful. We're hoping to hire someone to work with this organization specifically so that they'll get guidance and direction from people at the Community Law Center, but they will be the contact person for the community associations. So we're looking forward to great things with this group.
And anything in particular that you're hoping the group will be able to do?
Well, we started with the vacancies. That was our emphasis at the first meeting. But in talking with some of the people who were present, of course, you know, vacancies will spread to other problems in the community, such as cleanliness and safety. So I know that some other things are going to have to be an emphasis, too. But right now, it's the vacant properties that exist, both homes and people express an interest in vacant businesses, presenting a problem in neighborhoods also.
Our last phone call from Lorenzo, he mentioned about Detroit essentially raising blocks of vacant properties. Part of what Vacants to Value has done is to eliminate vacant properties by simply eliminating the property's entirety. What do you think of that?
Well, in some places, it's a good idea. It's very expensive. It's problematic in Baltimore because most of Baltimore's vacants are row houses. And so the city would have to purchase all the properties on a block, which is very expensive under the eminent domain laws. You have to pay fair market value for the property. If someone is living there, you have to pay for them to relocate. And then you have to get the money to demolish the whole block. If you demolish part of the block, you have to support the remaining buildings, and the cost of just supporting the outside of a remaining building is actually a little more than it costs to knock down an entire freestanding house in Detroit.
And I'm sure many people have seen what that looks like in Baltimore.
Right.
Sometimes you'll just see like one building left in an entire block with the sides replaced by cinder blocks.
That cinder block wall costs about, I think, $14,000.
And what do vacant houses, what are they valued at?
Well, it depends what neighborhood.
I think the assessment usually comes in between $3,000 and $5,000 for most vacant houses. I mean, so Grace has actually got the community garden next to her, or the little garden that she keeps up. She's modest about it, but it's a really beautiful, peaceful space in a neighborhood that used to be a vacant house. And I think that's kind of the best possible outcome we can see. But most of what Vacants to Value has done has been these big whole block demolitions in order to avoid that cost of putting up the, it's called a party wall, the abutting wall. But, you know,
I think a party wall?
Yeah. Sounds really fun, right?
It does. I hadn't realized it was that much fun.
But I think we can actually, I actually went to Detroit with Joan to a national conference around vacant properties. I think we can learn a lot from Detroit, and it is a different city. But, you know, the demolitions there, it hasn't always resulted in the best option. And then even in Baltimore City, where there has been demolitions, sometimes there's not a immediate plan afterwards for how that lot's going to be maintained. And that's a concern I hear a lot from residents, is that then we just have a vacant lot that's full of trash and high grass and weeds. And so maybe we're a little better off, but we're still, you know, it's still an issue for the community unless there's some kind of good use for that lot planned.
Maybe a little better off, but not necessarily much better off.
Right.
We're going to have to take another short break now. When we return, we'll continue our discussion about the vacant property crisis in Baltimore, as highlighted in a report released last week by the nonprofit Able Foundation on the city's Vacants to Value program. If you have lived on a block with abandoned properties, or if you have ideas about what the city should be doing to address the problem of vacants, give us a call, 410-662-8780. Send an email to midday@wypr.org. Hope to hear from more of you when we get back. Welcome back to Midday here on Your Public Radio. Nathan Sterner here in today for Sheila Katz. This hour we're talking about vacant properties in Baltimore and the city's efforts to reduce their large number. In studio, Joan Jacobson, who authored an investigative report for the Able Foundation about the Vacants to Value program, Robin Jacobs, an attorney and housing expert at the Community Law Center in Baltimore, and Grace Willis of the Greater Greenmount Community Association. And we do welcome your comments. Midday@wypr.org or 410-662-8780. Got an email about the city's housing authority, which has a program for donating houses. Is this an option for people who are struggling to pay off their liens?
Yes. So I think the city sometimes does accept donated properties. I can't speak for them on how that program works, and I have heard rumors that it's somewhat backlogged. But another piece I wanted to mention is that it is possible for the city to do an emergency demolition when there's a really seriously dangerous situation with a vacant property. I know I hear from a lot of neighborhoods that there's a ton of those. And what happens there is I believe the city gives some notice to the owner, an opportunity to correct, but then the city can actually demolish the property, and then that demolition cost becomes a lien on the property. So that's something you'll see the city do here and there. But like I said, demolition has to be very carefully done, and you want to make sure that the people in the community are protected and that there's a plan for hopefully some kind of asset coming out of it, like Grace's beautiful garden at the tail end.
And if you said that's particularly difficult to do emergency demolitions in rows of row homes.
Right. So if you've got two vacant properties next to each other and they're both falling down, you know, kind of the best and worst thing about Baltimore row homes is they really depend on each other, right? So you can't always just take down one and then the one next to it's just going to collapse if you start taking one down. So that's a way in which Baltimore is quite different from cities like Detroit.
And I guess it part of that difficulty is if those different vacant row homes adjoining are owned by different owners.
Yes, that's commonly the case. So the defendant in the lawsuit we were working on, the properties were really all over the place. None of them were next to each other. And sometimes they're next to a city-owned vacant property, or, you know, a lot of times they were next to a homeowner who had really suffered as a result of that vacant property from rats and vagrants and all kinds of negative ill effects. The property values are tied into these as well, and that's another piece of this that's really important to understand. When you have a vacant, it's really going to draw down the values of the properties around it.
Back to the phones now. Lance in Mount Vernon. Lance, you're on Midday.
Ah, thank you. I can't hear you very well. My comment was that the vacancy to values is a administratively heavy program. In other words, it requires a bureaucracy to administrate it at a lot of levels. You mentioned problems with the the developers taking advantage of things, etc. So what you really want to do, and any business analyst or retail consultant would tell you, you want to create a simple set of rules, simple playing field. And one of those possibilities would be land value taxes.
Thanks. Thanks for joining us, Lance. Land value taxes. What could land value taxes do to help?
I'll be honest, I don't know.
I don't know what that means.
You did make some recommendations in your report, Joan, though, about what the vacancy to value program can do better in order to help reduce vacancies in the city. Detail some of those for us.
Well, one is one recommendation is already happening, thanks to Grace and Robin, and that is the appointment of an independent vacant house council. Believe it or not, there's no independent or government entity just looking at the vacant house crisis in Baltimore. And so there's a recommendation to create that. And I think the meeting that Grace and Robin attended a few weeks ago, which Robin said it drew, 70 people, is a great beginning. Other recommendations really have to do with financing. The lack of financing to renovate houses is a real problem in moving the program forward. And the city should have to work with loan companies and community development finance corporations to try to put together pots of money to renovate houses. Otherwise, developers don't have nowhere to go. I interviewed one small developer who went to 10 banks and was turned down. I went to another developer who was also turned down by several banks. She ended up using money in her husband's investment firm to renovate houses on Madeira Street in East Baltimore. So, and they all seem to want to do more than they can, but they can't have access to the money. So that's another thing. Also, Governor Hogan recently mentioned that the city should demolish a lot of the vacant blocks. And so the state could help out with that because it is very costly.
What could the state do? Purchase up the...
The state could provide the city with the money to purchase the houses. If any houses are occupied in a block, the law requires the city to pay an owner occupant enough money to buy a new house. Tenants are given rent money or a Section 8 certificate. So the state could provide money to the city to do that.
A moment ago that you mentioned that the city should do something to help people afford to finance renovation. We had a call on the line from George in Baltimore who asked if the city is doing anything at all. I'll put you on the air now, George, but is the city really, Joan, doing anything?
For financing?
Yeah.
Not much. They had a $1 million loan fund that was available the second year of the program. That sounds like a lot of money, but it only renovated 22 homes. And that is a revolving fund, so when people repay it, they will be able to reuse it. But other than that, there's nothing. The city did post a job for a new position in the Baltimore Housing Department for an employee just to work on trying to get financing. But it was posted in August of 2014, and a year later, the job was not filled. I don't know if it's been filled since then, but it remained open for a long time.
George, did you have anything to add on that?
Well, yes, I just wanted to speak up for the small, I wouldn't call myself a developer, but, you know, I can understand going after people who buy hundreds of tax liens and then foreclose and then leave these vacant properties all over Baltimore. But I bought my properties, developed a couple, And then I have this one that I just can't get financing on, just like the other person that was just described. We're not deadbeat people, you know, holding on to these vacant properties. We just can't get financing. And I'm glad to hear that there are recommendations regarding financing, because that is the only reason that there are boards on my property, because it is so hard to get financing to develop the city.
And so that's something that the city will hopefully work on more.
Hopefully.
Grace Willis, what are you hearing from your neighbors about the vacants in your community? Are they working to fix the problem? Are some considering moving to escape it?
Well, in my particular block, we have a developer who is getting some funding from the city to renovate. We still have a few properties that are just standing there. Maybe just the facade is there, because either the person bought that property thinking they were going to be able to renovate it, and then they realized the cost was something they couldn't handle, so those properties are still standing. But they're fewer in number now.
Are people staying and hoping that those few will disappear?
Some of us have stayed, but most of the people, older people, have not stayed because they gave up hope when they saw so many vacancies. And they left maybe a little too soon, because PHD did come in and start renovations, but they got discouraged.
That's People's Homesteading Group.
Tell us what People's Homesteading Group is doing.
I'll let Grace answer that.
Right, they've renovated at least 8 or 9 houses in the block, and they are getting ready to do approximately 3 more. And then some other persons have picked up a few houses there, and they are renovating them. But we still have a few that haven't been touched.
And hopefully someone will.
Right.
The problem that Baltimore has with vacancies is obviously it's a huge one. It's a daunting one, and it is one that is not going to be solved by any means before Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake leaves office next year. What can the mayor do in the meantime, and what do you hope our next mayor will do to help take on the vacancy problem?
Robin?
I think that working with the communities is really key. I just went to 2 days of a summit, Vacancy to Value Summit, that the mayor and the Baltimore Housing put together, and I think there were a lot of good ideas there. I'll have to research this land value tax thing when I get back to the office, but I think it's really going to take all of us working together in order to deal with this issue. And I think the recommendations of the report, there's another study that's being conducted that the city has asked to be conducted by City Center for Community Progress. They're actually holding their national vacant property conference here in Baltimore next year. And Alan Malik, who's authoring that report, gave some of his preliminary ideas, and it dovetailed pretty nicely with, I think, some of what I was saying in my op-ed and what Joan has in the report from the Abel Foundation, which is really looking at these areas where the vacant properties are increasing, in the areas where that's the reason the number across the city is going up, and that's where we really need to figure something out. And the answer to that for me is listening to people like Grace, because they know the answers.
And there's so many more answers that we would love to give, but we're about out of time for midday today. I want to thank you, Joan Jacobson, Robert Jacobs, and Grace Willis, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And want to thank the providers of lunch for today's guest, Joe Squared. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. For locations and hours, visit joesquared.com. Come Monday, Sheila Cast will be back. She'll be sitting down with mayoral candidate and businessman David Warnock to talk about his plans for the city. Hope you'll join us for that at noon on Monday. I'm Nathan Sterner, usually the host of Morning Edition. Hope you'll join me for that Monday morning at 5 a.m. In the meantime, have a great weekend.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Melody Simmons and Connor Graham. The Midday intern is Adam Droneberg. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.